Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. It's listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this May Day Monday. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. Labor Party, Labor Notes, and Labor Organizing. It is International Workers' Day, May Day, and not a minute too soon. This morning on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick interviews Rand Wilson of Labor for Bernie and Our Revolution. They talk about the organizing Labor for Bernie is doing, questions about the future of the Democratic Party, and possibilities for Labor for Bernie as perhaps the early stage of building a Labor Party. From the Labor Notes-sponsored Portland Troublemakers School on April 8th, 2017, that was just last month, Director of Labor Notes Mark Brenner talks about the pending threat of national right-to-work legislation, and Jung Nam, high school teacher and organizer with Healthcare for All Oregon, discusses the importance of organized labor to the fight for universal single-payer healthcare. This segment was produced by myself, Denise Morris, your host this morning. Old Mole Joe Clement interviews Shin Steiner. He's secretary of the Portland chapter of the International Workers of the World, IWW. And on May 3rd, IWW will host a class, Intro to the IWW. It's a 101 class. It's Wednesday, 6:30 p.m. And the class is free and open to the public. They will discuss why unions are important and a little bit of what will happen in that class. We will close the show this morning with a short clip from the April 29th Climate March here in Portland. This produced by Desiree Helligers. It's Marisol Ceballos, who's talking about Pacoon and the harmful impacts of pesticides on farm workers. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting KBOO and programs like the Old Mole. And you can find us on the web, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now we'll turn to Bill and Rand.
Thank you, Denise. Rand Wilson, welcome to KBOO.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here.
Rand Wilson, let me introduce you. He's a union organizer, a labor journalist. He coordinated Labor for Bernie. For those who just woke up from a long sleep, Bernie Sanders startled the country and world. He ran as a Democratic socialist and amazed everybody by nearly winning the Democratic Party nomination for U.S. president. For the last 6 months, Bernie has continued his challenge. Labor for Bernie became Labor for Our Revolution. That's a national organization with local units established to carry that radical message and continue the challenge to business as usual. So, Rand Wilson, tell us about Labor for Bernie and now Labor for Our Revolution and the problems they face in putting the movement back into the labor movement.
Well, first of all, I want to give a shout out to everybody in your Portland listening area that supported Bernie Sanders, and to all of the union members and immigrants and labor activists and supporters who are on strike or marching and rallying today as part of International Workers' Day and as part of a day without immigrants. Today is, I think, going to be historic in the scope and scale of the mobilization by workers, union and not yet union, across the country in thousands of local actions and rallies and strikes. So I'm very optimistic about what's happening today and energized by the success of the Sanders campaign in the labor movement, not necessarily with the union leadership that got somehow tied into the status quo and to the Democratic Party's anointed candidate, but by the six unions that broke away from the Democratic mainstream to support Bernie at the national level, hundreds of locals across the country that endorsed the Sanders campaign, and 50,000 members plus that supported Labor for Bernie across the country. And that energy is what we're transforming or capturing or translating into a new Labor for Our Revolution as a segue with the Sanders campaign energy into a force uniting workers and uniting the labor movement to fix a rigged economy, as Bernie would say, and a a broken political system.
Let's talk about the challenge to the labor movement. You know, I have some sympathy for even the most conservative business unionists, the leadership of those unions. They're in a terrible bind because they've depended for so long on the Democratic Party for defending themselves from the rabid Republicans who want to destroy the unions and just defending some of the basic protections of the Wagner Act for unions. Of course, it's been a losing battle. They lose more every year. But you could see why especially the public unions are forced to support the Democrats because the Republicans would do everything they can to smash them. And in fact, the challenge now is really severe because these cases that are coming before the Supreme Court would greatly challenge the existence of unions in the United States. Tell us about that and the way in which, if labor is to survive as a real force in American life, it's going to have to change its ways of operating.
I know you're going to have Mark Brenner on later in the show talking about a national right to work bill, and we already have 27, maybe 28 states have already enacted right to work at the state level.
Right, right to work for less, yeah, for much less.
The movement for right to work for less is spreading across the country at the state level, and undoubtedly there'll be some support for a national right to work bill this year coming from the far right. And just as importantly, there's a case working its way up to the Supreme Court that's going to be similar to what we faced a year and a half or 2 years ago with the Friedrichs decision that was before the Supreme Court that would make compulsory union dues or a fair share dues payments by all members for the services of collective bargaining and grievance handling that the union performs voluntary. That Friedrichs decision was only defeated because of the death of a Supreme Court justice that left the court deadlocked 4-4. And now with the new Trump Supreme Court appointee, in all likelihood, they'll have the 5 votes that they need to win a decision like Friedrichs that would make membership voluntary and dues payments voluntary.
Yeah, it would reduce the resources of the unions by a great deal. As it has
in the public sector.
In the public sector,
that's
right.
That's going to be in the public sector, which is roughly, I think, about half of the union membership at this point is in public sector organizations,
right?
Including the organization I work for, SEIU Local 888.
So the unions really have to meet that challenge through a very different way of deploying power and asserting power, and that is it's got to come from below.
And there's going to need to be a very different relationship between the union leadership and its members and a much more actively engaged relationship. In order to win the support of the membership, you're going to have a much more responsive and much more energetic organization to inspire a voluntary participation. And so that's the silver lining in something like this is just that, we have an opportunity to have our unions be much more part of a transformational politics rather than the transactional politics that have really failed us with both Democrats and Republicans. And so I'm excited about, I'm not looking forward to the loss in revenue and the substantial diminution of our resources as a result of right-to-work bills and or a Friedrichs-like decision.
Right. We still have to fight them, but reality is that we also have to prepare for, if those things are lost, we have to prepare for what's coming.
Yeah, and what was so exciting about the Sanders campaign, I think for people that participated in it or watched it from arm's length, was the way that the campaign connected social movements and the labor movement to a new kind of electoral politics. And that's very much what we hope Labor for Our Revolution will harness and be a part of in this emerging Our Revolution groups that are emerging around the country. There's more than 900 groups and dozens of state organizations at this point that have consolidated the Sanders support into Our Revolution chapters and intent on continuing the political revolution. It's very, very exciting energy, mostly coming from young people, millennials that were energized and excited about Bernie Sanders and want to continue that work.
This is your Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO, Portland, Oregon. I'm Bill Resnick for the Old Mole, talking to Rand Wilson, union organizer, labor journalist, and coordinator for Labor for Bernie, which became a real force in nearly defeating the corporate Democrats headed by the Clintons, the neoliberals, in winning the Democratic Party nomination. History could have been very different, actually. Rand, let's talk about the continuation of this sort of struggle from below. Bernie's talked about it a lot. This can't be a one-person crusade, and he's not the king. It has to really come from below. There's no way of matching corporate neoliberal money from around the world, indeed, and not just the billionaires here. They certainly will have the money. The question is whether there is a real response from below. Right now, there's this battle for the soul of the Democratic Party or for just for domestic policy. Tell us about that.
Well, two thoughts. The contest that occurred between former Secretary of Labor Perez and Congressman Keith Ellison from Minnesota for the leadership of the party really was emblematic of the corporate center and the left grassroots of the Democratic Party. We came very, very close to succeeding with Ellison in a very hard-fought campaign that wasn't the slightest bit Democratic. This is for votes with Democratic Party insiders, and yet he came within just a few votes of winning. That was a kind of a proxy war that was symbolic of the array of forces inside the party. What you're seeing now is literally hundreds of young people who are jumping into the political arena, carrying the message of Sanders in contests for city council and for mayor and for state rep and state senator and for Congress all across the country. People are inspired by the Sanders campaign and are running for office and are enlisting the support of our revolution for their platform that is addressing the issues of inequality and campaign finance. Those are at the center of all of these campaigns.
Yeah, and it seems to me Bernie has done really well on the environmental, the enormous threat of climate change and the absolute necessity of changing the way we, in fact, produce and consume in this country. And it seems to me those movements are also connected. It's not just an electoral campaign. It has an electoral arm, and it certainly is headed for 2018. It's on everybody's mind now. All of politics, both parties in Washington are looking to 2018, and they're maneuvering right now, which is why the Republicans can't pass anything, because they're desperately afraid of the response by the people. In any event, it's not just an electoral campaign. It has to be a movement from below with feminist concerns, with especially environmental concerns, supporting immigrants and workers around the world, not just here. One of the reasons that people come from Latin America here is the way, in fact, those countries are being run also as kleptocracies, putting huge numbers of people at risk of starvation. It seems to me that all of those movements have to be part of it and have to organize at the local level if we are going to prevail.
Absolutely. And what's been missing, I think, for a while is that the movements haven't been able to unite and find an electoral expression. And the optimism that I feel from the Sanders campaign and from what's emerging now in our revolution is that we're finding our voice and connecting these grassroots movements that you just articulated and many more to candidates and really trying to shake things up. And the Democratic Party is really at a crossroads. Is it going to be a party of Main Street or Wall Street? Is this going to be a party for workers or for owners? I think the jury's out. The Democratic Party has to make some tough decisions about which way it wants to go. And it can't just be the happy talk that they've given us in the past. We've lost all credibility.
Yeah. One final question. What faces and what's faced left candidates who have won elections on radical programs like Mitterrand in France and a number of politicians in England is they face the forces of capital who go on capital strike and flight and who destroy the economy. We really have to come to terms with that structural power of the people who own the means of production, as we used to call it.
You know, the forces in the labor movement have the most experience of any movement in dealing with capital, confronting head-on the kind of power that the boss has in the workplace and in your community with your state and your national electoral and political apparatus. And so that's why labor has to be at the center and is so essential for any movement to succeed. Workers and the working class have to be a part of that and have to ground that movement in the reality of dealing with the capitalist system.
We have
a lot of experience with that.
There's so much more to say, and it's all possible. Thank you very much, Rand Wilson, for talking to us today.
My pleasure, and I look forward to hearing your other people on the show today. Happy May Day.
You too.
So when I say we are not drowning, if you can repeat after me and say we are fighting. We are not drowning.
We are fighting.
We are not drowning.
We are fighting.
Thank you so much.
Gracias. Come up as golden rod.
That's a little bit from the climate march that was this last Saturday, April 29th. Music by Porch Revival. We'll hear another clip from the climate march. Both pieces here are produced by our old mole, Desiree Helligers. And also later in the program, we'll hear Joe Clement and Shin Steiner talking about a class hosted by the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW. That's on May 3rd. We'll get more information out on that as well. Next up, however, we have a clip from Portland Troublemakers School, which is sponsored by Labor Notes. Every other year, they come into town and stir the pot a little bit around labor and putting the movement back in the labor movement. Mark Brenner and Young Nam were part of a workshop, Labor in the Trump Era, and they'll talk about right-to-work legislation and also universal health care.
What we want to do today is we want to hear from a couple of local union activists about some of the key challenges that we're facing as a labor movement in the Trump era, but mostly we want to have a conversation with you guys about what to do about all of these challenges that we're facing, because in many ways the million-dollar question is how do we address everything that's coming at us, not just to survive, but even maybe to thrive in this time. I think that in the Trump era, the challenge for the labor movement is, one is the stuff that's going to be done to us. The one that I'm going to speak to is the challenge of right to work. Certainly right to work and free, you know, the Supreme Court now has a full complement, very likely with Gorsuch appointed. We're going to have a new version of the Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association come through, some effort to get rid of fair share for public sector workers. So the idea that all of us are going to be working in an open shop in the not too distant future is a very real possibility. National legislation's already been introduced. But you guys know the list, right? It's not just that it's right to work. It's what's happening with every kind of health and safety standard. If you're in the building trades, all of the protections and, you know, kind of agreements you can get around project labor, around Davis-Bacon, all of these things that have sort of undergirded our unions for many, many years are threat. But we know what those challenges are. Those are the known knowns, as Donald Rumsfeld would say, right? The thing that I think we don't spend enough time talking about, and that's the second sort of major concern that I have, is the things that we're going to do to ourselves. Our labor movement hasn't had the best track record of thinking about how to respond to the challenging times. And I think that we've seen three kind of strategies that have really hit us and hurt us. I think they've proven unworkable for some time, but I think they're going to prove even more unworkable in the Trump era. One is trying to get a seat at the table. Basically, the idea is that somehow if we can get access, then we can figure out how to survive and what to do. That's essentially what we're seeing among some of the building trade union leaders right now. Like, Trump wants to build a lot of stuff, he's willing to open up the White House for us, we'll go meet with the guy and maybe we'll get something out of it. Thinking that a seat at the table somehow gives you power. A deeper problem that I think is also something we're doing to ourselves is a lot of union leaders are looking at this era like things are terrible. Our job is to essentially help people be realistic about what we can do and manage expectations. I know that you actually do need to try and talk to people about what's realistic given the forces that we can marshal against the forces that our employer can marshal. We got to have that conversation. But that's different than trying to lower people's expectations preemptively. And I think in our labor movement in this era right now, we've seen a lot of lowering of expectations. And I think quite the opposite is what is called for, that we need to really be raising expectations and aiming a lot higher. The third thing that I'm worried we're going to do to ourselves that I think is a longer standing problem that certainly doesn't stop or start with the election of Donald Trump as president is that our unions have a really bad track record when it comes to actually putting members in the driver's seat. And I think if ever there was a time when we are going to need members to feel like we are the union, is right now. But whether it's in the trades, whether it's in healthcare, we've seen over and over and over again, too many unions think about the way things happen from the top down. Like either elected leaders or even staff kind of say, this is what the union program is, this is what we're gonna do, and your job is to get on board with the program. That's the opposite of how you actually get people involved. Because if you really wanna bring people in, you can't go and say, here's what you're gonna do, take it or leave it. That's not an opening of a conversation about what's important to you. You know, what do you think we can do? And more than ever, we really need to start opening up these kinds of opportunities inside our unions to talk with each other about what should we be doing in this era. Because too many folks at the top think that's where strategy should get made. Whoever's in the room at the e-board meeting or when we're sitting down with the employer association, that's who should be making talking about strategy. And those of us that are on the job every day, that's not part of what we need to do as union leaders. And I think we need to turn that whole thing upside down. And that one of our key challenges is figuring out how to have exponentially more people who actually have the skills to do it, have the confidence to do it, and whether they get the authority or take the authority, actually to go out and be taking action on behalf of the union. And I think that's a problem that didn't start with Trump's election, but it's something that in this era, if we don't fix, is going to be a massive shackle around our ankles. I'm going to say a little bit more about those things at the end, but I'm going to start by turning to our panelists to open up on a couple of key issues that we've got. On my far left, Hyung Nam, who's a teacher here in Portland Public Schools and active with Healthcare for All Oregon. I was going to talk a little bit about what is happening in the healthcare industry and how this is affecting us as union members, what we can do to get off of defense and onto offense.
I'm about to take an unpaid leave of absence next year from teaching. So I'm looking at what that means. One of the things that it means that I will not get health care, and under the ACA, I will be required to buy health insurance in the exchange, or else I'm penalized. I'd have to pay a penalty that would be potentially, who knows, how many hundreds of dollars. So the lowest price health care, because I will not have any income next year, is $200-something a month for a bronze plan that has a deductible of $10,000 with a coinsurance of 30%. So that means that I will pay $200-something a month, and then not a single penny of the health insurance will kick in to cover me for anything until I pay $10,000 out of my pocket. And even then, I would have to pay 30% of all healthcare costs. So this is the kind of situation that we're in, that whether you're a worker or whomever, it is not sustainable. So first of all, I want to ask you, as union members, do you know what your healthcare premium costs for your employer and then for you? Do you know how it compares to what it costs if you were a worker in Canada or a country that has a real universal healthcare system? Do you think that your costs are higher or lower?
Higher.
Definitely higher, right?
Yeah.
Are you aware of how much the increases to your healthcare premiums and also your own out-of-pocket costs have been on an annual basis compared to your wages or salary? Have they been more consistently increased compared to your wages and salary?
Yeah.
How many of you think that negotiating over healthcare has been a major contract issue where you're pressured to give up other important things in your contract in order to hold on to your healthcare benefits?
Yeah.
Yes?
Trick questions.
And how many of you think that healthcare also is important as far as other kind of contractual issues about defining what is full-time work or part-time work, or the pressure to push people into part-time work rather than full-time work, negotiating about retirement, about leaves and wages and so on? Yes? So for all these reasons, I want to argue that unions have to lead the effort to fight for single-payer health care, basically an improved Medicare for all, which we know is popular among the people, and which really shows this idea, an injury to one is an injury to all, because Medicare for all puts us all into one single risk pool, right? It's social insurance. It's a model of solidarity where we show that we're all in it together and that we all benefit when we're in it together. This is something that will benefit not only Trump voters, it will benefit immigrants, it will benefit workers in unions and outside unions. So to begin with, when we're talking about healthcare, I'm not just talking about having access to healthcare and being healthy, I'm talking about bargaining issues. So that when you are a union, you should not have to bargain, have your employer use healthcare as a bargaining chip to get other concessions out of you. You should not have to worry about going on strike, because if you go on strike, you're going to have to pay your healthcare costs, and you're going to decide to weaken your power and not go on strike because of healthcare. You should not have to divide your union between top-tier workers and lower-tier workers over healthcare or over retirement. Those kind of divisions are toxic. And what we know is that universal healthcare works. Also, under the ACA, there is a threat of this excise tax, what they call the Cadillac plan, that really puts the burden of paying for the expansion of Medicaid, which is really important, a lot on unions. We are already negotiated for good health care that everyone deserves. We should not be punished and taxed 40% of our premium above $10,200 for doing so. With the universal health care, we're talking about a publicly funded health insurance, just like Medicare, which we know works. It works more efficiently than our private system, with an administrative cost of about 3%. It actually works insuring the oldest, most sickest people in this country. In a way, it's like a service to health insurance companies saying that we will take them all off your hands and have the government be responsible for that. Well, if we could add everyone else into the single risk pool, it would work even better. And it would really strengthen the power of workers and unions, because we know that in the U.S. we pay more for health insurance than any other country, any other industrialized country, or any country in the world, and we actually get worse results than other industrialized countries. And in fact, there are examples like Ford Motor Company in 2017 that is moving a plant from Mexico to Canada. They're not coming to the U.S. And one major issue is healthcare. They don't have to deal with the kind of expensive healthcare in the U.S. and also negotiating over healthcare. In 2005, there was a Toyota factory that moved to Canada as well, and healthcare was one of the reasons. So we're not only talking about bargaining power, the costs, but also being able to have jobs and workers not losing jobs because of not being competitive over healthcare costs. So the way to do this, oh, also one other thing I should point out, you know, of course, ACA has been a huge benefit to poor people. But ACA does not cover immigrants. We're talking about both undocumented immigrants and documented immigrants in the first 5 years. They are not able to benefit from the ACA as far as buying into the exchange and so on. So that is not universal health care. It is not solidarity. And labor unions are under attack right now. People are trying to portray us as all we care about are ourselves, especially public sector workers, right? If we lead the fight to gain universal health care for all, that is something that will benefit all of us. It will benefit our state budgets so that we can spend more money for social services, education, and so on. People will know that unions really benefit everyone. And when we talk about an injury to one being an injury to all, they will see that this is completely true, and this is the perfect example of that kind of a thing. So what you could do as a union is that movement for single-payer health care exists in every state. But there are 25 active states right now. Oregon's one of them. You could join Healthcare for All Oregon. We have 120 different member organizations right now. We have about 20,000 people in our database. We also have individual memberships. And by the way, you can get to all my information. Just go to www.hcao.org for Healthcare for All Oregon. And join our movement. One thing you could do is you can get your union to be a member of HCAO if it's not already. You will have voting power within our organization. We're a grassroots, member-driven organization. You could also join as an individual member. This is a movement that we want to have labor lead, and we're talking about ballot measure because of the supermajority issue as far as any new taxes, because we're going to be funding universal health care for all, just like Medicare is funded through payroll taxes. So that means that without being able to get a supermajority, we're going to have a ballot measure, whether it's a referral or a ballot initiative. And it's going to mean a grassroots campaign where we're going to need massive numbers of volunteers. We're going to need people to help do education of the public to understand what this issue is and not to be fooled by the health insurance companies and pharmaceuticals so that we can win this campaign. So we need you to get involved, and you can contact me and others in HCAO about how to present a resolution to your union, to get your union to join as a member, and then how to get your members active in educating not only people in your own union, but also the public about how this issue affects us all. From even our employer's perspective, the only people that benefit from not having universal health care, a single payer, are pharmaceuticals, hospitals that make too much money, and of course the health insurance companies. It's going to take us all to work together to win universal health care for all. Thank you.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio, and this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host. I'm here with Patricia Kohlberg. She's our engineer this morning. And next up on the Old Mole, we have Joe Clement, who interviews Shin Steiner. They are going to talk about IWW, Industrial Workers of the World. They have a class coming up that's free and open to the public, and they'll talk also about why unions are important.
What's your name?
Sam Scarlett.
What's your religion?
The IWW.
That ain't no religion.
The only one I got.
Who's your next of kin?
I don't have any.
Well, who's your best friend?
Big Bill Haywood.
He's in here with you.
He's still my best friend.
What's your nationality?
None.
Well, what country are you a citizen of?
I am a citizen of industry.
Where is your home?
Cook County Jail.
Before that?
County Jail, Cleveland, Ohio.
And before that?
City Jail, Akron, Ohio.
Look, are you a citizen?
No, I'm an industrial worker of the world.
Good morning. I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Today is International Workers' Day. And in recognition of that, the clip that we heard just before was the opening scene from a 1979 documentary about the industrial workers of the world called Wobblies. In the studio with me today is the secretary of the Portland branch of the Industrial Workers of the World, Shin Steiner. Thanks for coming on the Old Mole today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Joe.
This Wednesday, the 3rd, The IWW will be hosting a class called Introduction to the IWW. It'll be from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the IWW office at 2249 East Burnside. It's free and open to the public. There will be snacks provided and childcare available if you need it. I asked Shin to come on today to talk a bit about that class, but I want to begin our conversation by asking a question that may seem a little obvious, but which I think bears repeating again and again. Why are unions important?
Well, you know, I mean, honestly, it is a good question. And given just that until, in a lot of ways recently, union membership has been declining and the labor movement's been struggling to find a new way to focus its efforts, it's unfortunately unsurprising that a lot of people don't have a lot of familiarity with what the labor movement is and what a union is. I could say from the standpoint of the industrial workers of the world, we think a union is any time two or more workers begin to cooperate and communicate and take action at their workplace to directly change their conditions, their pay, and their lives.
Sure, but to play devil's advocate, a lot of people might say, well, I can just go talk to my boss when there's a problem. They have a open door policy.
Honestly, when things go wrong on your job and you just try and act on your own, you're going to get singled out, you're going to get written up, and you're going to get fired. When you and your coworkers come together, when you guys make a plan and start taking strategic actions to make your needs known and make them important to gain power and leverage, well, that's going to change everything. You might actually get what you want, what you need.
Could you give a little background on the industrial workers of the world, where it comes from?
The industrial workers of the world, or as we're sometimes known, the Wobblies, we were founded about 112 years ago, 1905, in Chicago, Illinois. We, since our very inception, have been a union dedicated to both the equality of the working class, but also the empowerment of the working class. We see our sort of vision of society as one where every workplace is run democratically. Those who don't own, you know, factories or roads or communication lines or intellectual property have to sell their labor. We view this as oppressive and as something to be ended. So we want something instead that's democratic, that allows us to actually have real power over how our economy works, both in a broad sense, but in a very real local sense as well.
What is the mechanism of power that workers have that we're trying to realize?
Anytime you do your job, you realize that your workplace doesn't run without you. If it did, you'd have already been on the street. You have power in what you're doing, in either withholding that, shifting those efforts, or otherwise coordinating with your coworkers to make work unfeasible, to make profit for your bosses impossible until your needs are met.
So how is the IWW different from other unions?
The way we tend to focus our efforts is all built around our mission. Like I said before, we are dedicated to workplace democracy, and so we conceive of our union not as a top-down mechanism, but as something that exists from workers themselves and decided by the workplace. So each shop of workers actually controls its strategy, it controls its goals, and its tactics. They are the ones who determine what they're going to do. No one else can for them. Not the branch. Those workers do. One of our primary focuses is that we are driven by our rank and file. In fact, we are entirely comprised pretty much of our rank and file. So in other unions, you have a lot of paid staff organizers who are often very talented experts, but they end up coming up with what grievances to go with, what bargains and what demands are winnable. And in the IWW, it's more about the workers in the workplace themselves coming to those terms. Even if they make a mistake, then it's a mistake that they have made together, and that's a learning experience. But more often than not, it actually they'll fight harder, they'll fight longer, and they'll fight more creatively than anyone from the outside because it's their lives, because they care. As a consequence of this, and as one of our goals around this, it also creates a sense of very strict direct democracy within the union, such that all members, regardless of what dues rate they pay, have the same power, the same voice, the same vote. And more explicitly, it's not just like a formal structure that you see written down in a constitution. That's also the way it's enacted. That's the way it's lived and practiced in the union.
So what is the IWW doing these days in Portland?
Well, we have actually a number of campaigns going on. So for starters, we have an affiliate, the Burgerville Workers Union, and we've been very active in supporting their campaign, providing any sort of tactical or resource assistance that they need. So that's been going on for, as of May Day, it's going to be about 1 year and 5 days.
And I understand there are a couple shops that have contracts that are negotiated through the IWW?
Yes. So there are two contract bartering units in the Janus Youth Programs, as well as a contract with called Safety, formerly known as the Women's Portland Women's Crisis Line.
And that Janus Youth Program, it's a shelter, right?
Well, Janus Youth, we have a contract in their homeless youth shelter. That's a streetlight, porch light, as well as a program they have for commercially sexually exploited youth. So to help get kids safe when they've been in very unsafe situations, we represent those workers.
Okay, so turning to this Wednesday's IWW 101, what would people hear if they came?
What they'd learn is just a brief little piece, a history about the IWW, but just where we come from, what our mission is, and sort of where we see things going. But more importantly, they would really learn about our model of union organizing, which is commonly called solidarity unionism. The way we view organizing is one that, is a model that's based in direct action, in the sort of actions that workers can take themselves rather than relying on labor lawyers or arbitration from the National Labor Relations Board or other parties to sort of mediate their needs.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour talking with Shin Steiner of the Portland IWW about their upcoming intro class, IWW 101. If you go looking for the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, online, you will either come across their website or maybe the famous preamble to their constitution, which I won't read in its entirety, but I wanted to ask you about a line that happens toward the end of it, and it says, instead of the conservative motto of a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, we must inscribe on our banner the revolutionary watchword, abolition of the wage system. Well, what does revolutionary mean in this context? What is revolutionary about the IWW's unionism?
So a lot of unions go for increases in pay. They go for better grievance models. They go for perhaps just an increase in benefits. And those are all vital to people. But they don't necessarily challenge the underlying balance of power. The reason workers have to fight to get what they need from their boss, to get better pay, to get benefits, to get health care, to get better hours, or, heaven forbid, less hours but the same pay. The reason they have to do that is because in the workplace, the boss is a dictator. The boss controls the flow of terrain. They control what happens when and how, or at least, that's the established order of things. The IWW sees this as the root of the inequalities in all economic activity. So we try and make sure that workers can come together and democratically take power back, that they, on their own terms and through their own actions, take charge of their labor, take charge of how work's done, of who does it and where, because they're the ones doing it. So in this sense, it's getting to the root. It's getting to the radical core of the problem. And in that sense, it builds a new way of living and of being and of relating to each other. When you see people really start to confront their boss together, when you see a coworker who's, they're going through hard times economically, and you've banded together because they're being singled out by their boss for any sort of unfair discrimination, and your entire crowd of coworkers marches on that boss, delivers a letter saying, you're going to stop targeting any of us for your retaliation, you're not going to play favorites, and you're going to give us all a raise, you see people start to come alive, start to think of themselves as human, as start to really understand what they're capable of. Because so often we just have to follow the orders of the boss, and we have to, you know, whether we like them or not becomes kind of irrelevant. We just do what we're told, and we start to think less and less, and to be less and less. The IWW is about waking us up. It's about taking power so that we can be who we are.
So if somebody joins the IWW, what are they getting out of that? What do they get?
Well, they get connection to thousands of coworkers and radical workers all over this continent, and in fact, actually the world, who will have their back, will be open to talking and help them think through conversations and organizing models and all the minutiae that come up in any campaign. But they also have people who, even here in town, will have their back, who will support them and mentor them and be mentored by them. There's no end of things. I mean, I've been in the union for 10 years, and I can't tell you how much I've learned from people that just come in off the street. Those lessons will be with me for a lifetime.
So before we wrap up, could you just say again when and where people want to be for this Industrial Workers of the World intro class?
So the intro class to the IWW will be held at 6:30 p.m. on Wednesday, May 3rd at the IWW Union Hall here in Portland at 2249 East Burnside. There will be snacks provided as well as childcare, though please contact us beforehand with any childcare needs so that we can have enough volunteers to take care of the kiddos. Email us at secretary@portlandiww.org.
I have been talking with Shin Steiner, branch secretary of the Portland IWW, about their upcoming intro class and what makes the IWW different as a union. Thanks for coming on, Shin.
Thank you for having me.
You've got to join that one big union. You've got to join it by yourself. Everybody here will join in with you. You've got to join the one big union by yourself. If that road gets rough and rocky, if the hills get steep and high, we will sing as we go marching, and we'll win one big union by and by. Brothers gotta join that one big union. Brothers gotta join.
Thanks to Joe Clement and Shin Steiner for that segment on the IWW. You'll be able to get that information by going to Portland IWW. Their link is to Facebook, I believe, and the class information will be there if you need to know, again, where and when. But it is Wednesday, May 3rd at their offices. Now, next up, we have a short clip that was gathered by Desiree Helgers, who attended the Climate March on April 29th, this last Saturday here in Portland. We'll hear Maricel Ceballos, who is an organizer with PACUN, and she talks a bit about the harmful impacts of pesticides on farm workers.
Hi everyone.
Hola a todos y todas. Gracias por venir hoy. Me llamo Maricel Ceballos.
I'm a queer Chicana.
Soy una Chicana queer.
And a proud daughter of a campesino. For those of you who don't know.
Para los que no sepan. Sepan.
The word campesino means farmer.
La palabra campesino significa el que trabaja en el campo.
And right now I'm representing PACUN, which is Oregon's farm worker union, as well as the farm worker movement.
Actualmente estoy representando PECUN, que es un sindicato de campesinos unidos.
So farm workers are arguably Oregon's most important workers. Woo!
Los campesinos son los trabajadores más importantes en el estado porque damos de comer a la gente.
We're the backbone of Oregon's $6 billion agriculture industry.
Somos la parte esencial.
Treated like second-class citizens.
Pero nos tratan como menos que los demás.
In Oregon, farm workers are exposed to deadly pesticides.
En Oregón, los trabajadores de campesinos están expuestos a condiciones peligrosas, incluyendo pesticidas.
This leads to a slew of alarming health problems.
Esto nos causa problemas de salud.
Our cancer rate
is 25% higher than the general population.
Sufrimos de cáncer en una tasa de 25% más alto del resto de la ciudad.
Campesinas and farm workers with wounds have a 50% higher chance of having a miscarriage.
Campesinas o los trabajadores que tienen úteros, que trabajan en el campo, sufren de pérdidas de sus bebés a un nivel 50% más que los demás.
And so for the general population, life expectancy is 78 years. But for us, it's 49.
Para la gente de la población general, suele vivir hasta los 78 años, pero para los campesinos solamente llegamos a los 49 años.
Farm workers are paying the price so everyone can eat.
Los campesinos pagamos para que todos los demás puedan comer.
That's why we're fighting back.
Por eso luchamos.
Yeah.
Founded in 1985, Becún seeks to organize workers to stand up against this kind of exploitation in the fields.
Empezamos en el año 85 y Becún existe para luchar en contra de la explotación en los campos.
Working in a migrant community, it requires us to use methods that are a little different than traditional union organizing.
Como trabajamos en el campo, tenemos que usar tácticas diferentes de otros sindicatos.
Which focuses almost exclusively on specific workplaces.
Nos enfocamos casi exclusivamente en sitios específicos.
Migrants operate in a different cultural and linguistic context and have been shaped by a different political and economic system.
Los migrantes operan bajo un contexto político y cultural diferente.
When they come here, they're cut off from reliable information.
Right. Cuando llegan a este país, no reciben la información de antes.
They're exploited and manipulated by unscrupulous elements.
Lo explotan y lo manipulan.
And they have to rely on inaccurate assumptions for legal rights and remedies.
No reciben información correcta en términos de sus derechos legales.
The resulting isolation and disempowerment is only worsened dealing with a society that is often racist and is anti-immigrant, and its laws and institutions and policies.
Los migrantes sufren de la pérdida de poder y también de aislamiento, que es típico de los demás, pero también es peor con esta población específica.
We are here to build a strong coalition to make environmental justice a reality.
Estamos aquí para crear una coalición fuerte para crear la realidad de justicia ambiental.
You can count on Becún to work hand in hand with you to bring about climate justice.
Cuenten con Becún para trabajar mano a mano con ustedes para crear la justicia ambiental.
¿Se puede?
¿Se puede?
Sí, se puede.
¿Se puede?
Sí,
se puede. Se puede.
Sí, se puede.
Thanks to Desiree for gathering that piece, and perhaps some other material will be filtering around KBOO from that climate march, I imagine. You're listening to KBOO, and this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. And KBOO, of course, and the Old Mole want to thank our members for your generous support. And if you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on donate. I want to thank everyone this morning, especially our fearless engineer, Patricia Kohlberg, and Bill Resnick, Rand Wilson, our troublemakers, Mark Brenner and Hyung Nam, and also Joe and Shin for their talk on the IWW. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this May Day Monday. Get out there. It's International Workers' Day. Let's celebrate and resist and fight.